v. Vasilevitz.
Thank you, Judge Flom. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is John Baker, and I am here on behalf of Dr. Markekis, and we are asking this court to reverse a grant of summary judgment that was entered by the district court in this case. This case is a First Amendment retaliation case, although it's not the typical one that finds its way to this court. Typically, when cases of the First Amendment appear here on retaliation, it's an employee-employer context. That's not what this is. Dr. Geekus is a dentist who has been licensed to practice dentistry in the state of Illinois since 1985. The defendants are individuals who are employed or were employed by the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation, who were tasked with regulating dentists in this case. The nature of our claim is that Dr. Geekus was retaliated against for engaging in free speech. Now, there's been a long-standing amount of animosity between Dr. Geekus and the department, and it started back in the late 90s with an individual named Michael Vold. Dr. Vold was the dental coordinator at the time. Dr. Geekus was accused of doing something improper, and Dr. Geekus met with Dr. Vold. When they met, Dr. Vold made some requests that Dr. Geekus found to be outrageous. He wanted all of Dr. Geekus's future prescriptions to be run through Dr. Vold. Dr. Geekus objected to that. Not only did Dr. Geekus object to that, but he went and arranged a meeting.
Mr. Baker, before you get any further into the merits, I think we have a statute of limitations question in this case.
Yes, Judge.
You're litigating over ancient history. The events at issue here occurred between 2002 and 2007.
2008, Your Honor.
Well, no, 2008 is when the department, the regulatory agency, agreed to withdraw the cease and desist order and dismiss the state court suit, but that was not anything adverse to your client. That was beneficial to him. So the actual retaliatory actions that he's litigating over began in 2002 and ended in 2007, arguably earlier than that, because I'm not sure that the cancellation of a meeting is a material
sufficiently
enough.
Sufficiently adverse.
Material enough retaliatory action, sufficiently adverse, whatever language you want to use to characterize it. I'm not sure that counts for purposes of a First Amendment retaliation claim. So, but, giving you the benefit of the doubt, it maybe runs to 2007, but not beyond.
Well, Judge Sykes, I would disagree with your suggestion for this reason. The statute of limitations in this type of a case, which is really a retaliatory prosecution case, before Dr. Geekus can bring that claim, he has to be successful. There has to be some element of success before he can allege the retaliatory action.
Well, that's true in some constitutional claims. I don't know that it's true in a First Amendment retaliation claim. It might be true in a malicious prosecution claim or something like that, where the proceedings have to end in your client's favor before you can initiate suit. I don't think that's the case with the First Amendment
retaliation claim. Now, Judge Sykes, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there. And, there is no real tort of retaliatory prosecution. Retaliatory prosecution is based upon a number of different constitutional amendments which are used to support the tort. In fact, I believe the Supreme Court just granted cert over that issue from a case
in this
court.
Right, but that suggests that at the very latest, the last of the acts that you're suing over here occurred whenever it is that the department filed the suit that it later withdrew in 2008. But the clock doesn't start when the department withdrew its suit. It starts at the last retaliatory act, which you're alleging was when they pursued him, among other things, the meeting, cancellation, and these other things.
And Judge, I respectfully disagree. I don't believe that's when it runs. I believe we could not have filed our suit because this is essentially a retaliatory prosecution suit. And a condition precedent to us filing that suit in the first place is a successful resolution or a resolution in favor of my client before the tribunal that held it. And so our perspective is not only was it not filed late, but we could not have filed it until those orders were entered in 2008. I mean, I think that had we brought that in 2008, we would have run into a, I don't know if it's Rooker-Feldman or collateral estoppel, judicial estoppel, the terms all come together to me, but there would have been parallel proceedings basically attacking the underlying grounds for why they were doing what they were doing.
But how, and I think the statute, how has the statute not run for the events in 2002, which is the raid, for the aggressive questioning of the attorney for your client in 2004, and the other events that occurred in 2004? The statute is clearly run on those.
The claims were brought in 2004. Now, the raid itself, whether that is...
No, your claim, you filed this suit in 2010. These actions happened in that you're litigating over happened in 2004.
The cease and desist order happened in 2004. And then as soon as the cease and desist order, or excuse me, the rule of show cause for a cease and desist order was issued, then the cease and desist order was issued in 2004. That case, the cease and desist order, whether it was properly issued or not by the department, was litigated. It was litigated in the department. It was litigated through an administrative proceeding in the Circuit Court of Cook County. Those cases were not completed until 2008. And our position is that the statute does not begin to run until that has been completed, because the very issues that we are challenging were before another tribunal, and we could not have brought this at the time. In fact, that's part of why Judge Mills kicked out some of our other cases, is because they were proceeding in a parallel proceeding in the Circuit Court of Sangamon County, and he said, "Look, those issues all need to be tried there." And so, you know, you're dealing with trying to thread a needle on what it is that you can and can't litigate. But I think that, and I, you know, we cited this, we discussed this in our response brief, about the way the court has treated retaliatory prosecutions. And that's essentially what this is a retaliatory prosecution. And there has to be some finding in the favor of my client before that type of claim can advance. And that didn't happen until 2008. So, you know, I understand that we're litigating issues that occurred a long, long time ago. And Judge Sykes, that does create a lot of problems because, you know, some of the people are deceased, you know, so you have a hard time, and I certainly understand it, and I understand the general principle of being concerned about stale claims, and it certainly is a valid concern for all litigants and certainly for this court. But at the same time, I don't believe we could have brought that claim, and had we brought it at that time, I think we would have been out on a different issue.
Well, what needed to be done on the doctor's behalf after June of 2004, when the cease and desist order was vacated?
He had to fight the cease and desist order. And what happened with the cease and desist order, the cease and desist order ended in 2008. It was in effect for 4 years, Judge Flom. It was.
What occurred between June of 2004 and December of 2008? What transpired?
Because I was not counsel of record, I can't say definitively of all the things that occurred. There were a number of meetings. I know, for example, there was a block of time there where the record reflects my client attempted to speak with the dental coordinator over 150 times, and they wouldn't respond to him. He was trying to get this cease and desist order lifted. And part of the problem was there was an attempt to try and find out why it had been entered in the first place.
Was it lifted as of June 2004?
No, it was in effect until 2008. It was entered in 2004, but it wasn't lifted until 2008. And so, you know, Dr. Geekus is a dentist, and he had no ability to challenge a cease and desist order because it was a cease and desist order to preclude him from practicing medicine. And I apologize, I do know my light is on, and I would like to reserve a moment for rebuttal, but thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Ms. Boachie-Ansa?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Linda Boachianza on behalf of the defendants. Gekas believes that he's involved in a long-standing feud with various officials from the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, but the record doesn't demonstrate that any feud exists or that any of the named defendants participated in it. Specifically, Gekas presented no evidence suggesting that his speech was at all related to any of the allegedly retaliatory actions that defendants took. Therefore, the district court properly granted summary judgment in defendants' favor.
Which of these defendants issued the cease and desist order and handled its prosecution
in 2004? Your Honor, I'm not sure that any of these defendants actually did issue the cease and desist order. I think that may have been issued by another department official that was not named a defendant. And the background behind the cease and desist order is essentially that the department had reason to believe that Mr. Gekas was treating a patient for a medical issue, which he is a dentist, and so obviously he's not allowed to treat a patient for medical issues, and so that's what led to the cease and desist order being entered. And as a factual matter, the department was not ordered to lift it. It independently determined that there was some question over whether that actually was a medical procedure rather than a dental procedure, and so they vacated the cease and desist order on their own.
And who did that?
That was, I believe, Bluthart.
Okay.
Yes.
But he's not the one who issued it and took it through the administrative and judicial process?
I don't believe so. I think that was someone else.
Did it ever get to the judicial process?
It didn't. It was being litigated within, or there. So it was being investigated within the department, and then Mr. Gekas filed an action in the circuit court concerning it, and so it was sort of working its way through those different channels, but the department ultimately decided to vacate it.
And that was Bluthart?
Yes.
On behalf of he's the director?
I believe he was the director.
Of the Department of Professional Regulation? And is that the charging authority, for lack of a better way to refer to it?
Is that the charging authority?
The department? Or who's the charging authority for
this
kind of claims?
The department. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, given like the number of defendants and various titles, I'm blanking on exactly what his role was. But he was the director of... He did have the responsibility, or he had the authority to make decisions on behalf of the department. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
But well, I'm just trying to get clear on who was responsible. To the extent that this is a claim for First Amendment retaliation,
yes,
that keys off of the institution of this cease and desist proceeding,
mm-hmm,
it's important to know who was responsible for that. And whether we have the right defendants here, setting aside the timeliness question.
Yes. So Bluthart was the director of the department's Division of Professional Regulation. And so
he's at the top of the hierarchy in the department?
Within the Division of Professional Regulation, yes.
So it would be his responsibility to issue cease and desist orders? Or we just don't know.
I can try and see if we have that in our briefs. I don't recall off the top of my head. I believe that it was someone else who actually issued the cease and desist order, but I'm not seeing who that person is. But Your Honor, in order for Mr. Gekas to have made out a prima facie case of First Amendment retaliation, Gekas had to show that he engaged in constitutionally protected speech, that he suffered a deprivation that was likely to deter free speech, and importantly, that his speech was a motivating factor in any of the defendant's decisions. When we look to Gekas' complaint and his filings as a whole, we see many allegations, but no evidence of retaliation. Gekas believes that the department entered the cease and desist order in retaliation for his 1988 conversation with the deputy governor. But nothing connects that 1988 conversation to the cease and desist order in 2004, and no inference of discriminatory intent can be drawn from conduct that took place 16 years after the speech. Defendants also took two actions against Gekas, or rather involving Gekas, in 2004 and 2005. Ranielli, who declined to speak to him because he was under investigation by the department, and Lagatuda, who canceled the meeting with him. As Your Honor kind of suggested, we also question whether these actions amount to deprivations that would be likely to deter free speech. But even if they were, Geekus presented no evidence showing that his speech played any role in those decisions. And in fact, Ranielli testified in her deposition that Geekus's letter did not play any role, that it was just her regular practice not to speak to dentists who were under investigation. The district court's judgment also can be affirmed on the basis of the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations for a 1983 action in Illinois is 2 years, and the claim accrues when the plaintiff knows or should have known that his constitutional rights were violated. In this case, Geekus complains largely of actions that took place in 2004 and 2005, and we think that this case is similar to discriminatory discharge cases, where this court has observed that the proper focus for statute of limitations is on the time of the discriminatory acts. So Geekus suggests that he knew immediately that the department's actions were retaliatory, and so by latest he was required to bring any claims concerning these actions in 2007. His failure to timely raise them provides another reason to uphold the district court's judgment. So unless this court...
He argues that this is analogous to a malicious prosecution claim, where the doctrine says that the judicial proceeding that is the basis of the claim has to terminate in the plaintiff's favor before suit can be brought. I don't know that that's the doctrine in the context of First Amendment retaliation claims, but what's wrong with that argument?
I don't know that that's the doctrine either, but even if it were, the proceedings really weren't terminated in his favor. The department, in the sense that the circuit
dropped it.
Right, the department dropped it. The circuit court didn't order the department to stop the proceedings. The department just decided on its own that this is not, you know, a worthwhile venture, and so they stopped it. So the proceedings really weren't resolved in his favor, although I don't agree that that's the right framework with which
Because malicious prosecution is different in materially relevant ways from a First Amendment retaliation claim. So you can win a First Amendment retaliation claim, I suppose, without necessarily showing that there was absolutely no basis for the action that you're challenging, but you can't in a malicious prosecution claim.
That's right. So unless this court has additional questions, we ask that you would affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baker, you have 1 minute, I guess.
So little time, so much to say. A couple of things. I just wanted to respond real quickly to a statement that was made. The final order from the I believe it was from the circuit court, said the decision was vacated and declared null and void. And this focuses on the problem that we have. They've never explained why they had to do the cease and desist in the first place. 4 years he was not allowed to treat this particular patient. 4 years. No basis for it. They never had anything for it. That's retaliatory. I want to go back and I want to address one of your questions, Judge Sykes, and that was about the names of the individuals who were involved. The Department of Professional Regulation, it's now Financial and Professional Regulation. It just used to be Professional Regulation. Boothart was the director in 2008. Director Boothart died, I believe, in 2012, 2013, something like that. Prior to Director Boothart, I believe that there was an individual named Gria, or I can't remember the name. It's in the record, but there was a previous director who was the one who actually entered the cease and desist order. The cease and desist order, however, was based upon the actions of the dental board, who are defendants in this case, based upon the investigation that was done by Mr. Vassilatis and Mr. Rinelli, who was the dental coordinator at the time. And they were involved in that decision to issue that. So that's the basis for them, whereas the director at that time had very little involvement other than signing off on the piece of paper. We ask the court to reverse. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Speaker. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.